where you wanna be.
Tell me what your life is.
What's with your life?
Running like a rare disease.
Running like a rare disease. Ghetto people.
Stop giving up yourself.
Stop doing what you're doing to yourself, yo. You got to learn to love yourself. Ghetto people. Ghetto people.
Motherland Media is on the air. You are listening to African Perspectives on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com, and blacktalkradionetwork.com. African Perspectives, where we talk about the issues of our day from an African worldview, an African-centered perspective. This program is unapologetically African. It is a custom in the African tradition to ask elders for permission to speak. Having been granted permission, to our ancestors whose shoulders we stand on, to our elders whose shadows we walk in, I greet you, my dear brothers and sisters and friends, in the language of one of the greatest civilizations on this planet. It gave the world the basic disciplines of knowledge of science, math, architecture, music, writing, law, religion. You name it, we did it. The Greeks called it Egypt, but they called themselves Kemet, and Kemet means land of the blacks. So I greet you all in the Kemetic language, the word of peace, Hotep. It is always an honor and a privilege to pour libation because we truly do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. We're going to use water because water has no enemies. Water is the great cleanser, the great purifier. We pour water into the earth to invoke the spirits of our ancestors, and we say the word Ashe, which simply means so be it. So we pour this libation to God for all that God has done and for all that God will do. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to Mother Africa, birthplace of all humanity, everyone who has lived, everyone who is living, and everyone who will live in the future. We have a common ancestral root. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. I mentioned Kemet. Kemet was the height, the apex, the zenith of African high culture. But there were other cultures as well, such as Timari, Punt, and Nubia. So we pour this libation to classical civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to contemporary civilizations of Africa, of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Benin, Great Zimbabwe, great civilizations that were flourishing while Europe was still in a medieval or dark age. So we pour this libation to those contemporary civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the brothers and sisters who suffered the Maafa, the Infakani, the Holocaust of our enslavement, uprooted out of Africa, laying a carpet along the Atlantic Ocean. They are now in North America, Central America, South America, and throughout the diaspora. So we pour this libation to brothers and sisters who suffered the Holocaust of enslavement, of captivity. We do not know their names, but because of them, we are here. So we honor them and their sacrifice. We say Ashe. We pour libation to those men and women who fought against enslavement. If you ever heard me do a libation, you'll know that we were not slaves. I repeat, we were not slaves. We were captives. What does a slave want to do? It wants to get free. There's over 400 recorded revolts of our people fighting on the continent, throughout the Middle Passage, and this hemisphere. We resisted. We were not slaves. A slave is somebody or something that submits its will to a master, and we haven't and we will never submit. So we give honor and reverence to those men and women who fought. Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser, Harriet Tubman, Nat Turner. and many, many others. We honor them. We respect them for always standing and fighting for the liberation of our people. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to those unborn, those young men and women who will once again lead us back on the stage of human history as a free and proud and productive people. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the spirit of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. We need each other. We don't have good community life because we don't have good family life. Conditions shape conduct and consciousness. The conditions in our community are bad. The conduct towards each other is bad because we lack consciousness. Consciousness is more than just awareness. It's a deeper understanding of who you are culturally, historically, and the necessity to come together to produce family, which is produces good community life. So we pour this libation to the spirit of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. We say Ashe. Shem Hotep means go in peace. Esante Sana means thank you. Good morning, African world. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com, and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And I am your host, Brother Oshi. Peace, family. I hope everyone is well. Hope everyone is enjoying this day so far. Hope you have a great weekend. Hope you get a chance to do all of the things that you want to do, need to do, should do, better do, must do, can do. And I hope that the weather is accommodating for you to do it. But if it isn't, that's right, brothers and sisters, you got to do it anyway. So just get it done. Hope that this weekend is great for you. You're listening to African Perspectives, and we're here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., 10 to 12 Central, 9 to 11 Mountain, or 8 to 10 Pacific time, or any other time around the world. But if you cannot listen live, you can go to timeforanawakening.com and then scroll down on the right side, look for the red, black, and green lion with Africa imposed. And click that and look at the previous recorded programs that are dated and titled. They are dated and titled. And check out any of the past programs of African Perspectives. On Mondays, our lineup on Mondays, Acres of Diamonds public affairs programming from 6 to 8. And then right after that on Mondays, Let's Buy Black 365 from 8 to 9. It's also podcasts. It is, you can check them out on Facebook or YouTube. Okay, I'll find out. Tuesday, Dr. William Rogers, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. on Tuesdays. On Wednesday, Revive with Sister POC, Revive, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. on Wednesdays. And on Thursdays, Us Lifting Us, the Economic Development Cooperative for Our People in the Spirit of Ujamaa, Cooperative Economics, or as we like to say, Family-Centered Economics, ULU, every Thursday, 9 p.m. You can learn how to be part of that co-op, part of the team that will help us deal with the economy within our community. The question you need to ask yourself, who should be in control of the economy within our community and within the African world? Who should be in control of that? You know the answer. And the answer is Us Lifting Us, ULU. Today is Friday? Yes, today is Friday. 8 o'clock? If it's Friday and 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern time, no doubt about it, it's time for an awakening. Time for an awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Check them out tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern time. Tomorrow, Saturday, Sports Talk with Troy Wilmore. Saturday, Sports Talk with Troy Wilmore, 10 a.m. to 12 noon. And then Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. No, it's not me. 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Sunday is Sister POC, Revive, Proof of Consciousness. And then Sunday evening, 7 p.m., once again, it's time for an awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. You can give us a call. You can call us and be a part of this conversation right here. You can call 215-490-9832, 215-490-9832. The Ulu Cafe, it is open Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. Saturday, Sunday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. The Ulu Cafe is located 2036 Sylvan Road here in Atlanta, the Sylvan Plaza. And come check us out. If you want to check us out on their web, please do so. CAFEULU.com. Ulu. CafeULU.com. If you want to check out Us Lifting Us and check out the Power Summit that just took place. I gave a recap of it this past Monday. Definitely inspired by the Ledge Group. We'll be talking more about them and we'll be talking to them. You can go online to usliftingus.com. Usliftingus.com. But if you want to dial something, dial the cafe and get your espresso, your smoothies, coffees from Ethiopia and Tanzania and Kenya and Cameroon. I love the Cameroon Boyo. It's good coffee. And also, too, great teas. All of the stuff that we have, brothers and sisters, provide. The teas, the pastries, and everything, the wraps. It is us lifting us, as it should be. And the number to call, 470-788-8124, 788-8124. Call in your orders. You can just pick it up because I know you're going to be on your way trying to get to where you got to get to. So, Us Lifting Us. Let's Buy Black. Or no, We Buy Black. I apologize. Not Let's Buy Black. No, this is WeBuyBlack.com. Sell on WeBuyBlack.com. You can sell your stuff. The largest online marketplace for American, African-owned businesses. Check them out. Like I said, I met the brother in the mall, and I was impressed with what they were trying to do, because that's what I'm about. I got to get my boy in here next week, because there are conferences next Friday. That's right, the Republic of New Africa's conference is next Friday, March 29th through April 1st in Detroit. So we'll get some details and talk about that next week. Get him on the horn for Monday. See if you can talk about the Republic of New Africa. The 21st Century Black Survival Conference is going to be April 14th right here in Atlanta at the Shrine of Black Madonna. The 21st Survival Conference, dealing with areas in spirituality, culture, and survival. The spirituality component will be done by the master teacher, Ashra Kwesi. African History and Spirituality, the Origins of the Bible and Quran. Culture will be dealt by my good friend, Brother Mwalimu Baruti. Baba Baruti is an outstanding brother. Great school here in Atlanta. He'll be talking about a warrior's character. And the survival component will be the irritated genie, African survival in the 21st century. You won't want to miss this conference, April 14th, right here. There's also a conference the following week in D.C. I will have more information on that conference in D.C., the following conference. Also, too, on Fridays, on Blog Talk, my good brother, Brother Yusuf Muhammad, Disaster Awareness for Community Preparedness from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern. Disaster Awareness for Community Preparedness. And to dial, to listen to the program, you dial 563-999-3089. 563-999-3089, my good brother, Brother Yusuf Muhammad. Once again, too, to go to that Ledge, to check that out, and also to check them out on our website. I'm really going to be pushing this because they're doing work. They're on the ground on the continent doing work, helping the brothers and sisters to grow food, to use the land. In fact, Ledge Group, LLC, it's Land for Environmental Development of Group Economics. So go online and check them out. Yeah, brothers and sisters, another beautiful day in the neighborhood. A beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? Won't you be my neighbor? A couple of things we're going to talk about today. One, in the second half of the program, talk about, is it race or is it class? There are many of our people, particularly those of our people who have are in a better position, so to speak, believe that it is a class issue, that really race, you know, number one, there is no such thing as race. There is no such thing as race. Race is a human construct. There's only one race, the human race, of which African people are the fathers and mothers of. One race. And if you want to call that. So there's cultures. There are cultures. But Caucasians devised or created the concept of race. And you can look to two individuals in the history, Carol Linnaeus and Johann Blumenbach. And they created this concept in the 1600s of and dividing human beings of Caucasoid, Negroid, and Mongoloid, and other stratifications. Of course, giving themselves the top position, they are the most evolved of the human species. They're the most evolved. In fact, they say we couldn't evolve at all because our skulls calcified, it hardened, and therefore there was no brain expansion. You know, the things that these Caucasians have said and done is just unbelievable. That's why I'm saying, get out. Get out of this madness. Get out. So we're going to talk about whether it is race or is it class that is an issue for us here. But in the first half here, we're going to, I was going to talk about something I saw on Atlanta Black Star. As you know, I always go to Atlanta Black Star for outstanding narratives and video streams. And you should check out AtlantaBlackStar.com. Just go to periodically, make it one of your favorites. Go to Atlanta Black Star. Just check out some of the topics. Well, they had one topic going there about the minister, about the Women's March. Many of the Women's March people are leaving because of Tamika Mallory and some of the other women who are in the lead of the Women's March, and because of her being at the Nation of Islam's Savior's Day. And she has done this based upon what she has said for many, many years, you know. But, of course, the minister has been and will continue to be a lightning rod, and particularly for those who feel that every time he speaks, we have to make those who support him repudiate him. Make politicians, and they've done that. I mean, the European Jews are, and to me, I wish I was, I wish I was in a position to tell them to go poop themselves. I wish I was in that kind of position, you know. I wish they were saying, I want you to repudiate Louis Farrakhan. But of course, you know, because the reality is the minister. And in fact, I'll tell you what. We'll play the piece that you've probably seen. It's been going around on the, what is it, Facebook. It's going on Facebook. And this is a piece that has been going around. It's not long, so we'll play this particular piece. We'll play this particular piece.
Have you noticed how certain social, educational, and political topics become off limits? Especially when it comes to unveiling and identifying the people behind the world's most heinous atrocities. In school, we were always taught that critical thinking was good, but that only applied to certain subjects. Take, for example, the Jewish Holocaust, a horrific episode of the 20th century where millions of Jews and non-Jews were killed by Nazi forces. As sad as this is, some treat it as blasphemous to question the historical accuracy of events associated with it. Or compare the 11-year Holocaust of European Jews to the centuries-long enslavement and oppression of countless millions of Africans, which was 100 times worse than the Jewish Holocaust. In fact, history proves that Jews played a prominent role in the transatlantic slave trade. In 1992, Dr. Abraham J. Peck of the American Jewish Archives was unmistakably clear about this history. He states, "The first two centuries of the black Jewish encounter in America were highlighted by a fairly extensive record of Jewish slaveholding. Indeed, during the colonial period in the small Jewish community of the time, almost every Jewish household of any form, North or South, possessed at least one slave. Though Jewish historians admit this history, they've made it virtually illegal for black folks to discuss or analyze what they've done to us, which is why we never learned this in public schools."
You act as though it is sin to critique you.
In fact, public education places more emphasis and sympathy on Jewish suffering above the enslavement of black people, of which they played a pivotal role. And if educators critique or comparatively analyze these topics, they can be charged with anti-Semitism.
And that anti-Semitism is indeed a problem.
This is why those Jewish-run groups like the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center falsely call Minister Farrakhan an anti-Semite and call the Nation of Islam a hate group just for citing historical facts. Sadly, mainstream reporters don't publicly challenge the ungrounded claims of those groups because they could easily lose their jobs. That's how the good work of Jesus was misinterpreted, to the point where the people were persuaded to call for his death. It's because so-called Jews were behind the manipulation of information and the political policies that turned the people against a righteous man. His only crime is having the nerve to expose the truth about the synagogue of Satan.
See, the Jews have control over those agencies of government. Oh, boy.
Did you know that these Jewish groups today still claim that Jesus' gospel is filled with anti-Semitic rhetoric and hate speech? So it's no surprise that anyone who really follows Jesus will be hated the same way. Even sadder is that some black preachers have sided with those same Jews who hate Jesus to attack the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. Here's the point. Their strategy is to defame the character of a man and a movement so that the people won't listen to the truth that they have to offer. That way they can isolate and attack them and there'll be no public outcry. That's how they did Jesus, and that's what they've done to all of our freedom fighters.
Every black man of consequence was called an anti-Semite.
That's what they're trying to do today with this false anti-Semitic hate group slander. The reason those Jews hate Minister Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam so much is because the Muslims pinpoint the real culprits most responsible for this mass deception and oppressive rule.
It is truth of what has been done to us by your people.
And since these culprits can't defeat the truth that the Muslims prove, then they use their leveraging power in media and politics to slander and besmirch the Muslims.
Get DHS, DOJ, education, and every relevant federal agency focused on tackling this issue.
The same interest groups that make these claims refuse to publicly debate or discuss these charges with us. I wonder why.
See, we want them to challenge what we say.
See, instead of intelligently discussing whether or not the NOI is telling the truth about Jewish involvement in the slave trade and their current exploitation of blacks, they just paint the Muslims as the enemy so that the people won't listen.
Farrakhan is toxic to a large swath of America due to his anti-Semitism and black separatism. He's a man with a history of controversial statements, maybe his most cringe.
Leaders can't even discuss how Israeli Jews have been torturing the Palestinians and Ethiopians without being called anti-Semitic. Again, they've made it practically illegal just to point out the wrongs that Jews have done, especially against black people.
This is because you know your history and you know what you've done to us, but you don't want us to know and you don't want us to share that knowledge with our own black brothers and sisters.
So critical thinking is disallowed, and those bold enough to publicly acknowledge this truth are punished and labeled as anti-Semitic. The same way their ancestors punished any black person for reading and writing during slavery. Critical thinking related to their wrongdoing is considered a crime.
And we need to put the full force of the Justice Department behind it.
The minister has put his life on the line proving that what he says is true, while none of those who call him anti-Semitic can support their lies. See if they'll offer their lives to prove if he has done anything anti-Semitic. They can't, because their entire existence and domination is based on lies and deception. And we can prove that.
And tell them, come on out and meet Farrakhan in the public. You can't defeat Elijah Muhammad's wisdom.
Their greatest fear is not nuclear weapons. The arch deceiver's greatest fear is the messenger of truth, who causes the people to think critically. That's the truth that will make us free. Free from their deceptive control.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. That was the Nation of Islam talking about the attacks on the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. And, excuse me. And these attacks have been going on for quite some time because that's what they do. And will they ever come to a debate or a discussion about? In fact, to me, I've often said, and I will continue to say, number one, let's be very clear, brothers and sisters. These are not, I repeat, these are not the Hebrews. These are not the Jews of ancient times. These are European Jews. These are Caucasians. These are late converts to Judaism, but now who dominate and control Judaism. They're even calling somebody anti-Semitic is a lie, is a misnomer. Okay? Because they're not Semites. They are not. They have no, when they did the DNA, there is no connection to the African Hebrews. And others, this other, like even the Sephardic Jews, there's no connection. These are the Ashkenazi Jews who dominate and control Judaism today, who dominate and control in a number of fields today. They are not the Hebrews or the Jews of ancient time who could rightfully lay claim to Palestine and take it and call it Israel. They are not. So that's number one. But understand this, brothers and sisters, they can't come to the table to debate and discuss this with Minister Louis Farrakhan. What they do is what they've been doing. Disinformation, lies, deceit, making some of us, particularly the religious people, because the religious people, the Christians, they are told, in fact, it's in their theology to support Israel, to support the Jews. I'm going to tell you, man, if I gave some folks a religion, now I don't practice it, it ain't about me, but I gave it to them and contained in there, they were to give me undying support. Boy, that's And that's what has happened. The Christian right and the conservative Christians, the fundamentalist Christians, the evangelicals support Israel to the hilt, because contained in the book that they have structured says that they will be blessed. So all of these scary Negroes who have succumbed to that, whatever. because I try my best not to cuss on the radio, and that's our policy here on Motherland Media, as well as Time for an Awakening. We don't use the N-word, and I don't use it, period. I don't use the B-word to describe our women or the N-word to describe us, not even in an affectionate manner, if that is an affectionate manner, to use a degrading and dehumanizing term. You mean now it's a term of endearment? Nah. But there are some times, boy, a word needs to be said, you know? A word needs to be said. And so the other night I was listening to Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot, Brother Richard, Sugar Honey Iced Tea. Sugar Honey Iced Tea. S-H-I-T. Yeah, okay. Sugar Honey Iced Tea it is. But anyway, no, they can't. And just like, in fact, I would venture to say, if anybody would come out to discuss this or debate this or whatever with Minister Farrakhan, it would be one of us, one of the Negroes who is a staunch Christian, who believes in these Yahudis, who would do everything that they feel that would be of pleasing to them to do, to argue. It's the same thing. There were many, just like Ward Connerly was arguing against affirmative action, just like this Negro in South Africa before Nelson Mandela was even released, let alone become the president of South Africa, arguing on behalf of the apartheid regime of South Africa. There's always some traitors, some agent provocateurs, some Negroes, some kowtows.
This call is being recorded.
Who will always be there to do the bidding of their master at the expense of us as a people, you know. So I'm saying to us, you know, understand this. Understand this. We got a caller. Let's take a caller. We got a caller this morning.
Hey, Brother Oshie.
Hey, Jay, how you doing?
Good. Listen, I'd like to thank you for using the music that I recommend, and now you're using Sugar Honey Iced Tea. Man, you my hero, bro. You know what I mean? You just use all of my good stuff.
That's right, brother.
I thank you very much, my African brother, OG. Listen, I've made a commitment not to talk about Minister Farrakhan no more on Time for Awakening. So I basically cannot say or will not say anything in regards to this subject. But I do want to let you know that I'm listening, and when you start discussing your subject matter on the next hour, I will then definitely call in, because I'm not going to try and get no brother or sister on Time for Awakening and any type of nonsense because of what I feel. Because you know the enemy is always listening, and they're waiting for a reason to attack. And, you know, like I told you Monday, I have to call Brother Elliot and Richard up tonight and apologize to them also in regards to, you know, what I said on Sunday. Because, you know, we're in a situation to where things are about to get real, real hot and heavy. And it's at a point that we really don't have no voices. We don't have no leadership. We really don't have anything to protect our African selves. That's why we have to use this program and Elliot's program and some of the other conscious people that are on this air to solidify our brotherhood and sisterhood. Because, you know, it's getting to the point now to where as this Negro peen is running rapid. You know what I mean? He's doing more recruiting to what they're trying to put on the planet than we are recruiting and putting on the planet. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, we at a war that there should never be a war about. You should never be at a war of living the African-centered principle life in some European, Yoruba-dominated existence. Because that's all it is, an existence. Because when they have no more use for you, they get rid of you.
That's right. That's right.
You see? So, you know, we have to figure out how we're going to be able to connect and put forward where we're going as a people. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And this is why I'm not gonna fall into that trap, and I won't do it. But you know, everybody knows my position, and you know, you have to figure out what's best for you at some point in time in regards to leadership as an African, best based on what they present. It's just like right now. I think about the predominant intellectual African at this time putting forward an agenda of where we should be going based on deeds and practices and writing and putting forth information. I always have to look at Madiwana Baruti, because right now, if you really read his works. His works is some of the most phenomenal works out there. And let me tell you something. It's like I tell anybody. His works is not easy works to read. You got to really, really sit down and take time to read his books and to understand what he's saying. But based on his writings at this time and what's being put forward from an African perspective, I don't know anybody right now who's doing what he's doing, bro.
I would agree. I would agree.
I don't know nobody. I mean,
you know,
who's writing on the level that
right.
that he is.
Right, because
I'll say this: Eric Taney Genie does a good job on lecturing, but I don't know what books he's written or anything like that. But what I'm saying is, Baruti right now is continuing the legacy of Dr. Ben, Dr. Kauf, and Sturdivant, Hilliard, and all of the other great scholars who put down the flying work. You know what I mean? So, you know, that's the way I'm going to leave it. But I got to do a little something right quick.
Okay, my brother.
Start your next hour. But I'm definitely going to call you back because I know the next hour is going to be powerful, and I know you want to deal with this subject matter a little more. Hold up, brother.
Hold up there, brother. All right, Brother Jay. I look forward to you in the next hour. I can comment on any and everything that Brother Jay says, but I definitely agree with Baba Baruti. I love him because, number one, this program, African Perspectives, deals with what? Independence, self-determination, liberation, and sovereignty for African people. And that's what Baba Baruti is all about. We're in concurrence with each other, no doubt. I'm going to read this thing from, I'm going to read this piece by Amari Jackson, Atlanta Black Star, and it's from a few days ago. And of course, you know me, I've always changed the wording around. I changed the wording around because, if everybody says words have power, words have meaning. Well, to me, if that is the case, and it is, and I agree, then we need to change our vocabulary. We need to change the way we say things and how we say things and when we say them. And so I don't use the word slave because we were not slaves. I don't use the word black because we are not black. You know, I don't use the word white to describe them because they are not white, you know. So I try to have the right verbiage to paint the right picture because that's what is important. Well, we got a caller. Let me take this caller, 602.
Yes, Brother Oshie. Good morning,
my good friend, Brother Marcus. How are you, sir?
doing great, good brother. Doing great.
Good.
You see that Yehudi, he's one of our biggest enemy, because it was him, you know, who railroaded Garvey's program, you know. He was a Jewish judge by Judge Julian Mack, was a member of the NAACP, and a Zionist judge. Yeah, and the prosecutor, they railroaded Garvey.
Yes.
You know, Garvey's program, and sent Garvey to prison and then deported him out of the country. So these Jews, you know, I remember when Dr. Tony Martin was, when he, you know.
Yes, before he died, no doubt.
Yes, and he wrote that book, The Jewish Onslaught, you see. Mm-hmm. But when he posts that book on them, they run. You got to know what to put on them, you know.
Well, let me say. Like when. Let me say this, Brother Marcus, because really, and they have really no leg to stand in. This is what they do is what they do, and they stand back and take pot shots. They can only do that because they really, I mean, they came into their existence on falseness, okay, on a fallacy. They are not Jews by the definition that people would think. These are Europeans. These are Caucasians who converted to Judaism about 1,000 years ago. They had a choice, either accept Christianity or accept Islam. They said, no, we didn't accept either of them. They come out of the eastern part of Europe, around Turkey. They are not Jews. They are not Semitic people. So to say that somebody says something against them, they're anti-Semitic, is a damn lie.
Exactly.
You know?
And
of course, they control things. And the perception that they wanted to have of us and them was that we stand together in the civil rights movement.
Exactly.
We stand together as a people who are oppressed. Is BS.
The
relationship, of these European Jews and us is that they're the merchant, we're the buyer.
Exactly.
They're the landlord, we're the tenant.
We're the tenant.
They have the money, and we borrow.
Exactly. And that's why when they said, oh, let's join together, they got a pocket full of money and we are broke. You know what I'm saying? You know, that's why. And they fund the NAACP, they fund CORE, fund the Urban League, you know. It's ridiculous.
And so what I was going to talk about was the European Jews' influence in the Women's March. And how they're losing staff people because of Tamika Mallory, one of the leaders of the Women's March, who has been going to the Savior's Day every year for some time, based upon what I've read, and that she would not denounce Minister Farrakhan, you know, because that has been their thing. I remember when they first did it way back in the 80s, because he said something about Adolf Hitler being wickedly great. Now, you can use that in a number of different terms. Now, of course, now the influence of them has been so profound and so deep. In Germany, you can't even damn mention Adolf Hitler's name. You know, you can't have a damn swastika or none of that in Germany. That's how profound and such an impact these European Jews have made on that situation. You know, but here you can have all kinds of Nazi stuff and all kinds of other stuff going on. But that's not the issue for them, though, really, because the issue for them is how they manipulate and undermine and maintain control. And that's a reality. That's not made up. That's a reality.
That's the reality. And you see, but what they do, you know, in America, what they do, you know, to black people, they use black people as a buffer between themselves and the Anglo-Saxon, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. They use us as the buffer, because they know if we weren't here, the same thing that they experienced in Germany, they would experience it here. So they need us as the buffer between them. But you see, as I said, there is always a slip between the cup and the lip. And they're on the losing side of history. I'll hang up and continue listening, brother.
Well, all right, my brother. Thank you, brother Marcus. Because the reality is that these European Jews, and understand this, they are not, it is a religion. Judaism is a religion like Christianity, like Islam, like other Taoism, Hinduism, Buddha. They're religions. And in those religions, anybody supposedly who wants to be a part of it or to practice it should be free to do so. But of course, some are tied to cultures, and the culture that of the European Jews is tied to manipulation. I see it. That's how it is. And I wish somebody would hear this and be willing to come on and discuss it. Although I don't want to debate with anybody. It ain't about debating, because the reality is this is the facts. This is what has been known. Do the Jews control diamonds? Yeah. In fact, the largest import in Israel is diamonds. The largest export in Israel is diamonds. Where they get them from? South Africa. Arms and so forth go to South Africa, to the Caucasians, to continue to suppress our people. Oh, man, we could go on, so we're not. Here's another issue that I'm going to bring up before I deal with my second half of the hour issue, is indigenous people to this country. There are many of our people now who are believing that we are the indigenous people of this country. Some of us are even saying that we are not African. Some of us are even saying that they don't believe that the Africans sailed, that Africans were brought here by Caucasians. Some are even saying that indigenous people were taken from here and sent to Europe. All kinds of stuff. Denying that, they had all this. Where are all the boats at? Where are all the slave ships at? You know, a lot of this is going around, you know. But one thing I remember distinctly, was listening to a sister in Oklahoma when the government finally settled with the Cherokee, talking about reparations and giving them money. And what they said, if you cannot prove that you're 100% Cherokee, you get nothing. So all of those brothers and sisters who went on the Trail of Tears, all of them who were there, because they can't prove that, supposedly, they get nothing. Once again, brothers and sisters, Dr. John Henry Clark, we have no friends. You want a friend? Go look in the mirror. And don't leave that mirror until you like what you see. Not your hairstyle or the shape of your cheekbones. No, like who you see culturally, historically. Like who you see when you see another brother or sister, you like them. Like who you see within yourself, the confidence you have in yourself. Like who you see us as a people. We have no friends. Everywhere around this planet, African people are relegated to the bottom rung of any socioeconomic ladder, so to speak. African people are being dogged out everywhere. Malik Shabazz. Africans will be disrespected until Africa is under the control of Africans. Pure and simple. Captive African people, the part of the Trail of Tears narrative no one told you about. This is Brother Amari Jackson. This is Atlanta Black Star. Contrary to popular historical narrative, the Union's effort to rein in the Confederacy and end the secession military rebellion, now known as Civil War, was incomplete upon the iconic April 9th, 1865 surrender of Robert E. Lee at Virginia Courthouse in Appomattox. While ending the conflict in Virginia, the legendary courthouse meeting between Lee and Ulysses S. Grant prompted a series of subsequent surrenders in numerous southern states and western territories over the following months. On June 23rd, a full 2.5 months after Appomattox, the war finally came to its conclusion at Doakesville Settlement in present-day Oklahoma with the surrender of Stand Watie, the last Confederate general to lay down his arms. Wade, a staunch Confederate whose loyalty and battlefield exploits had earned him the rank of Brigadier General, was perhaps far too complex for our sanitized and more linear national historical narrative. He was an indigenous person. I repeat, he was Native American. I repeat, he was an Indian. A Georgia-born Cherokee who commanded Southern troops in the indigenous territory consisting of battalions of Crete, Seminole, Cherokee, Osage natives. He was one of many indigenous who left their southern lands behind 3 decades prior and entered the Oklahoma Territory by way of the infamous Trail of Tears, a series of forced relocations enacted by the government's authority following the Native or Indigenous Removal Act of 1830. And like a number of his Native brethren, Wade was a wealthy planter and landowner who was accompanied on the Western Trail to the Oklahoma Territory by a sizable number of captive Africans he owned. What people need to realize is that enslavement or captivity was not just, quote, African and Caucasian, said Dr. Archie Coleman, a nationally recognized historian of African and indigenous descendant people. Coleman, who has held numerous faculty appointments, is the author of That the Blood Stayed Pure, American Africans, Native Indigenous People, and the Predicament of Race and Identity in Virginia. He's the author of the book, That the Blood Stayed Pure, American Africans, Indigenous Americans, and the Predicament of Race and Identity in Virginia. Every time you see a pictorial representation, the iconic photos of the Trail of Tears, you only see indigenous people, stressed Coleman, noting the truth of the matter is certainly didn't leave their captives behind. The truth of the matter, they certainly didn't, because that was money. We can't ignore the fact that the 5, quote, civilized tribes were actually captive states legally, where they did not practice captivity, said Paul Chat Smith, associate curator at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American for the American Indigenous People. Smith, a Comanche, noted the need to put the term civilized in quotations gives us a skewed 19th century Eurocentric application to the southern-based Cherokee, Chickasaw, Choctaw, Crete, and Seminole nations. The author of several books on Native American culture, Indigenous American culture, recently facilitated the museum's American exhibit, which included information on the Trail of Tears and the Finding Common Ground Symposium, exploring American-African and Indigenous relationships. While slavery was not practiced in many of the communities in the same way that it was done in Mississippi and Alabama, in terms of numbers or being essential to the economy, Smith stressed, they clearly took a position to support captivity, to enforce it in their lands, and to actually fight for the Confederacy. So it would have been pretty hypocritical to talk about the role of indigenous removal being part of these large historical processes while ignoring the undisputed historical fact that indigenous nations practiced and protected the institution of captivity of African people. Although Native Americans, long before Wade, and like many cultures, had practiced in the captivity of prisoners of war within and between their own cultures, they didn't engage in racialized chattel slavery until the 18th century amidst the increasing encroachment of Caucasian settlers. While this violent encroachment and its associated civilization efforts by Caucasians impacted and influenced all of the 5 major groups, it was the Cherokee Nation that most actively engaged in and profited from Southern captivity of African people. Coleman has pointed out that by 1809, 600 captive Africans were held in the Cherokee Nation alone, a number that increased by 1,600 by 1835. It was during the 18, 30s, in the aftermath of the Indigenous Removal Act, that the decade-long process known as the Trail of Tears occurred, fueling the desire to claim the lands of those believed to be godless savages, where the Caucasian settler government-backed wish to expand the cotton industry and the recent discovery of gold in parts of the South, particularly in North Carolina. As a consequence, thousands of indigenous Americans were evicted from their common lands and forced to walk thousands of miles to designated indigenous territory in the current-day Oklahoma, many dying from starvation and disease along the way. One of the smaller factions of Cherokee who supported removal to the Western Territory as the only way to preserve the Cherokee autonomy was among those who signed the 1835 treaty that ceded native lands in Georgia in exchange for the Western Territory, while he and the Africans he enslaved would make the move west in 1837. Of the estimated 15,000 Cherokee in Georgia forced onto the Trail of Tears in 1838, as many as 4,000 of them died. Once in indigenous territory, Waity and other native captive owners resumed and even increased their heinous and profitable practice. Captivity in native territory became a mirror image of captivity in the white South. In the Caucasian South, said Coleman. She further explained there were already established codes with native territories dating back to 1827. The Cherokee Constitution, which stated, "The descendants of Cherokee men by all free women, except the African race, whose parents may have been living together as man and wife, according to the customs and laws of this nation, shall be entitled to all the rights and privileges of this nation, as well as the prosperity of the Cherokee women by all free men. No person who is a Negro or mulatto patronage, either by father or mother side, shall be eligible to hold any office of profit, honor, or trust within this government." There's even been codes to keep in line the free African populace, given there were free African populace living among the Cherokees, the Choctaws, the Creeks, and other groups, Coleman added. "I learned a narrative that said that there were some really basic differences between the treatment of people enslaved or in captivity by indigenous people and those who were captive by Caucasian people," says Smith, of a popular yet questionable historical theme that emerged in the 1970s. But more recent scholarship has really demolished that argument. While noting there were certainly variances in the ways in which it was practiced by certain states and territories, Smith stressed that one thing we know about captivity, that it was well documented. It really was about metrics, about money, about careful record keeping. And given that captives were very expensive and the majority and a major investment, so it is not a valid argument to say that somehow captivity under indigenous people was any significant degree a kinder or gentler form of captivity. It was captivity. And it was brutal, no matter who did it. By 1860, there were over 4,000 captive Africans living in the Cherokee Nation alone. Upon the Civil War in 1861, Waity didn't hesitate to join the Confederacy, given his common interest with the wealthy captive holders of the South and his view of the federal government as a Cherokee primary displacer and enemy. So the U.S. government, the so-called North, he was against them anyway because they had him removed. Remember, it was Andrew Jackson who came down there into Florida and Georgia and Florida and have them removed. He was pivotal in establishing the first Cherokee regiment of the Confederate Army known as the Cherokee Mounted Rifles. In his securing early Confederate control of native territory, unwilling to acknowledge Confederate defeat upon Lee's Appomattox surrender, Waity would ultimately close the epic military chapter of America's most historic internal conflict by finally laying down his arms to a Union Lieutenant Colonel Asa Matthews at Doakesville, Oklahoma, on June 23rd. This is a little-known conclusion to a pivotal American event. This is why America, this is why history is so important, and Sister Coleman, prompting the value of more nuances and accurate account, regardless of where the truth may take you. When you say captivity was only African and Caucasian, or African and European, continue Coleman, it erases the other part of that story. And of course, the other part of that story was the captivity placed upon us by indigenous people. We're going to have a break. We're going to take a break. And when we come back from that break, we're going to talk about, is it race or is it class? What is most problematic? Brothers and sisters, you are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. You can call us at 215-490-9832. And I'm going to play today a good instrumental. This is War. City, Country, City. It's kind of long, but it's great. I know you'll love it. You're listening to African Perspectives. Stay right here with us. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. You have just heard War. Yeah, brother Papa Dion and them Congo, Lee Oscar and them Monica and all them brothers. It's good. It's a good piece, one of my favorite pieces. As you can tell, I love instrumentals. I do. African Perspectives here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern. On Mondays, Acres of Diamonds from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Right after that, Let's Buy Black 365 from 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. On Tuesdays, Dr. William Rogers, Black Reality Think Tank from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. on Tuesdays. On Wednesdays, Revive with Sister PLC, 8 p.m. to 10. On Thursdays, Us Lifting Us ULU, the Economic Development Cooperative for Our People, in the spirit of Ujamaa, or as we like to say, family-centered economics, 9 p.m. until on Thursdays. On Fridays, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, time for an awakening on Fridays, 8 p.m. This tonight, check them out. Tomorrow, 10 a.m. to 12 noon, Saturday Sports Talk with Troy Wilmore. And then Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. No, it's not me. It's Revive with Sister POC. And then Sunday night, 7 p.m., time for an awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Dealing with a number of subjects today. Right now, we're going to talk about from New York Times, an article written in the op-ed section of the New York Times by Ralph Richard Banks. Ralph Richard Banks is a professor, a law professor at Stanford University. He is the author of Is Marriage for White People? How the American-African Marriage Decline Affects Everyone. And he is working on a book tentatively titled Why Black Boys Fail. Why Black Boys Fail. A new study rebuts a widely shared view that racial disparities in social mobility are economic inequalities in disguise. The belief that if we address class issues, we can fix racism. The report by Stanford economist Ra Chatty, the Harvard economist Nathaniel Herron, and colleagues at the Equality of Opportunity Project. The Equality of Opportunity Project, right, provides empirical basis for an economic susceptibility that black parents like me have sensed. Across generations, we are less likely than Caucasians to raise, and when we do, to rise, and when we do, we're less likely to later to fall. We seem unable to grasp or preserve economic gains as other groups do, including Latinos and Asians. The study's findings built on the author's prior research that his empirical data substantiated two insights about intergenerational economic mobility. One is that a child's economic position is sticky. Children from affluent families are more times more likely to maintain their privileged status than children from poor families are to retain it. The other is that while economic mobility may be individual, the conditions that enable or retard it are social. Wealthy neighborhoods with good schools and strong social ties propel even poor children toward a brighter future. But the reality for American African communities is grim. American African families trace our economic insecurity in part to a gender divide that we see often and don't discuss. We know that American African daughters tend to do well. They climb their socioeconomic ladder as high as their Caucasian peers, if not higher. It's the boys who fail, the young men who fail, whether born to rich family or a poor family, in an impoverished neighborhood or wealthy one. American African young men lag behind their Caucasian peers as adults. American African young men who grow up rich are twice as likely as their Caucasian counterparts to end up poor. And those American African young men who start life off poor, nearly half will remain so in adulthood, while more than two in three of their Caucasian peers will escape the poverty of their youth. American African women may surpass their Caucasian counterparts in individual income, but they will lag in household income. The men who would be their husbands are missing, incarcerated, unemployed, unable to be the partners that women want or that parents, that children need. So the failings of one generation fell upon the next, as the trajectories of American African young men are shaped by the absence of American African fathers. Looking beyond the usual focus of how individual children are affected by the presence of their fathers or lack thereof, Mr. Chatty and his colleagues found that the presence of American African fathers in the communities powerfully shape a young man's trajectory. American African fathers are a social resource. Two-parent families that don't form perpetuate American African disadvantage across the generations. The economic predicament of American African young men with connections from their children threatens to ripple across families and generations. All of which raises the question, how do American Africans in the 21st century confront the prospects of being indefinitely left behind? See, indefinitely left behind, just like what they said about us, that we were a permanent underclass. They said this about us about 20-some years ago, when they also were talking about the demographers saying that these demographic changes will take place by the year 2050. Now they're saying it's going to take place by the year 2040, which, of course, is only 22 years from now. That's why these Caucasians are acting the way they act. They don't want to be a minority. In fact, if anybody saw that Tucker Carlson on Fox talking about some demographic changes in a particularly Pennsylvania town, that now, because they're still the same Caucasians there, but now that a number of Hispanics moved in, the demographics has changed. The cycle that research documents had a beginning, and it can have an end. An American African woman began to take advantage of the opportunities opened by the civil rights movement. American African men were hit first with deindustrialization, the loss of well-paying blue-collar jobs throughout large swaths of our nation, and then with a surge in incarceration unlike anything a democratic nation has ever seen. This so-called democratic nation imprisons more people than any country around the world, and the predominance of us is ridiculous. American African children bore the brunt of their parents' suffering. Many well-meaning Americans, Caucasians, remain oblivious to a national tragedy. American African men's disadvantage has shaped not only how they are perceived, but the meaning of Caucasians. Many American African men's disadvantage that shape not only how they are perceived, but the meaning of race as well. Racial disparities in incarceration, unemployment, and school failure. Few racial biases, which ensures American African young men, rich and poor alike. American African young men like my own. This is the author speaking. Like my father is the author speaking. I'm not speaking. I'm just reading. At least I'm trying to read, huh? American African young men like my own go from cute and cuddly to strong and manly, and so become a threat in the eyes of many. The bias, subtle yet pervasive, compounds the disparities by undermining the relationship and hope that one needs to get and stay ahead. And so the cycle continues. But it need not. We can disrupt the cycle of American African disadvantage. What we've lacked is the will to do so. We see the real problem in this situation, brother, is that we may have the will within society to do so, and believe me, we do, because we're always trying hard. We're always wanting to vote. We're always wanting to march. We always want legislation, put people in public office, all this kind of stuff. They don't have the will. I wish we would have the will to be who we are. Just like Marcus Garvey said, up you mighty race, we can accomplish what we will. But the Caucasian in society definitely does not have the will to make things right in this society for everybody. This society was not created by them to be some kind of experiment, some kind of multicultural, multi-ethnic, integrated, assimilated society. No, this was created by them, for them, for their prosperity. Period. What we lack is the will to do so. We act as though economic inequality is inevitable, relegating poor children of all races to schools to which most parents would never choose to send their children to. Schools often in neighborhoods where most people would not choose to live. We segregate ourselves by race and class and accept the inequality of opportunity that doing so breeds. So many Americans profess to be blind to race, which ensures only that it will remain salient. So many worry about what appear to be racist, then working to remove the enduring tint of enslavement and segregation. We will find a way to undo intergenerational racial disparities when we find the will. And to find the will, we need to recognize what's at stake. The conditions that challenge us imperil the future of American African young men and American African families and the viability of the American dream itself. Okay, professor of law professor at Stanford University, Ralph Richard Banks. Let me say this, Brother Ralph Richard Banks, that no matter what you say, no matter what you do, these Caucasians can give less than a rat's beep about you, about us, about your sons, about my grandsons. This is a system of dog eat dog. This is a system of individualism, materialism, greed, and violence. Because of individualism and materialism is, and of course what supports that is the theology, particularly Christianity, is the main reason why we as African people here in America and globally cannot come together in the way that we should and must to benefit us. We can't do it because we don't care about each other. We only care about ourselves. And so what if 80% of us aren't doing well? That the half of that 80%, 40%, are living at or below poverty. And the other 40% are 2 to 3 paychecks away from being at or below poverty. So what? We look at the history of 400 years here, and the last 50 years of the civil rights movement has progress. We have so many people who are in public office. We have so many people who are this, that, and the other. No, we don't. And even the ones that are in public office ain't about nothing. Them not being able to say to the Caucasian, to the European Jews, no, I'm not going to repudiate anybody. In fact, I would repudiate you for what you are doing to Palestinians, for what you are doing to Africans, for what you have done in South Africa, for what you're doing around the world. And I repudiate you. It is not going to happen. As much as you would like to happen, as much as you would like to believe that it can. And I know there are a lot of our people who do. Because that's what we have been consistently fed. That's what's been beating into our hearts and to our minds. That this struggle that we have is so noble and so righteous that it really affects the Caucasian in a positive way. Yeah, right. Because if it really affected them, if we were able to use the moral persuasion and to appeal to them in a righteous manner, that it really would affect us in a positive way. Why is our condition worse today than it was even 30 years ago? Why are we behaving in the way that we do? Why is our hatred amongst each other and our hatred for ourselves so deep? And it's not just here in this country. Because, see, what's problematic is that because here in this country, you know, here in America, you know, this is the land of opportunity. That's why I had to laugh in that article. It says the Organization for Equal Opportunity. This is the land of opportunity, which is something I would never argue against. It would be ludicrous for me to do so, because there's been proven cases of individuals who have come to this country, some who have risked shark-infested waters, some who have put their savings into a lottery, some who have stole away, some who have whatever surreptitious means to enter this country have done so and have succeeded based upon the material wealth that they might have gained. If that's how you want to measure the success, they have succeeded. So I can't argue that. Every time I say that, it reminds me of that commercial many years ago of this Asian dude. I think it was Vietnamese or something. He's on a boat. He has a three-piece suit on, and he has these women behind him. I became rich. I just got here long ago, and you get my book. You buy my book. And everybody's got a book of how to do it. And I understand that. You know, you can become wealthy. You might have a talent. I ain't talking about what we do individually. Individually, what we do individually is weak and pale in comparison to what we could do collectively. Individualism is a European Caucasian desire. Individualism. But collectivism is an African imperative. It is a must. It is how we as African people maintain and survive and thrive and thrive. See, I just don't want to just, you know, we just exist and we hope. No, I want us to break up out of this and thrive. I want us to understand the importance of controlling everything about us by us. We can't do it here. It can't happen. We can live here individually. Some will live okay, some won't. In fact, some will live okay. The most of us won't. That's the design. It never was designed for us to do well collectively. And because of the idea of individualism, when one does succeed, if you want to use that word, they look down on all the others who didn't. And with the attitude of, I got mine. And if you didn't get yours, it's your fault, because it's there to be gotten. No, brothers and sisters, this is not a class struggle. This is not a race struggle, because there's no such thing as race. This is an issue of culture. Whose culture? What the Europeans have done is impose their culture on other humans. When they went into a place, they deemed that whoever, wherever they was, because they felt they were the most enlightened, that it was primitive, that it was something to not to give it any note or any thought to. In fact, it was so that if it was eliminated, it was good. But if we could impose upon that group our culture, our ways, our religion, that's what we want to do. But if we can't, we'll eliminate it, because what we want is the resources and land and our expansion. That's what we want. And we work together on those who are outside of us. We will do in any and everybody that comes in our way, particularly those who challenge us. And I'm saying that to say, what's going to happen in South Africa? I'm anxious to see what's going to happen, and not only in South Africa, but Africa itself as it begins to exert itself in this century, in the next upcoming decade, removing a lot of the boundaries, developing an African currency that Muammar Gaddafi was talking about. The African Union is proposing that at this time. You see, in this country, there is what happens to us is by design, and it will be that and worse. Those groups of individuals who are doing well, who still don't want to understand how important it is for them to put the resources behind eradicating all the negative things that have happened to us, the mass incarceration, the miseducation, housing, health, all of these things. They won't do it. They won't do it. They feel they have no allegiance. Number one, this is individualism. I ain't worried about what happened to you. That's unfortunate to you, but hey, so be it. You should have went to school. You know, you should have stayed in school. You should have been hanging out. You know, you should have went to college. You should have went to a trade school, technical school. You know, got a skill. And maybe one of our corporations, businesses, or whatever would have hired you. You know, believe me, I don't believe everything that I read. I don't even believe everything I see. What I do believe, based upon the history, I believe that Africans who were once great can be great again. If there was no history of us being independent, being self-determining, being liberated, and being sovereign, if there was no history of us having been able to do that and grow within that, then I don't know. I would just be in a position to say, hey, let's do, no. The fact is, we've done it. We did it so well that people came to sit at our feet. We were the light of the known world for thousands of years. Not a few decades, not even a millennial, but literally thousands of years. The foundations of many of the civilizations of ancient time, contemporary time, and today are African. But as you can see, some of the things that we talked about today, there's disdain and disgust towards African people. In fact, many groups think it's just to steal from us, to take from us, to kill us. I read a piece last night. I was going to read it today on the roots of cruelty and murder and mayhem against other human beings. You know, and I read the whole thing. I know the author was a European Jew, and of course it does mention the African Holocaust, but of course it the Ma'afa, the Infakani, but of course it mentions, implicates to what happened to the Europeans, Jews in Europe, you know. Because the reality is, my belief is that Europeans are a warring people. They are constantly at odds with themselves and others. And one thing that they've been able to do better than anybody is find a better way to kill. A better way to kill, from crossbows and catapults and Gatling guns and cannons and guns that can fire 1,000 rounds a minute, whatever those numbers are, AK, XR-15, AK-47, whatever the hell it is. Weaponry, superior weaponry. That's what facilitated their rise. That, along with shipmaking and map, shipmaking and the maps, That's what facilitated the Europeans' rise, because if he just went there without the weaponry, he would not have been able to take the lands of other people. But because the other people knew, some said, I'll fight to the death, but some had to acquiesce out of just basic survival. And the European is the only one that I know of in terms of recorded history who have, in recorded history, who have actually imposed genocide on other people. They're the only ones I know in recorded history who have imposed genocide. Genocide of Taino people here, which is now Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Genocide of the Tasmanian people, Truganini. They're the only ones. They're the only ones that now, when you look at the world, how it's configured, even when you look at the world in a political map, how the lines are drawn, all of this is European dominance and control, particularly over the so-called darker-skinned peoples of the world. Got a caller, 646. Is that my brother Jay?
Yeah, brother Ochi, I know time is about to end. Listen, the reality of this is the position of this so-called elite Negro peon is dwindling. If you notice, the resources in this country for white folks is dwindling. That's why you got this rabid retard in the Urugu house trying to talk this nonsense about making America great again. America was never great for black folks. America will never be great on the world stage because this idiot is going to mess all of that up, because basically what he's doing now is trying to go at this thing solo. And the world is waking up to what their position should be. You know what I mean? You got the BRICS. You got, you know, China, which they just do this tariff on that's going to just absolutely wreak havoc on America. You know what I mean? Because now when tariffs go into play and there's a reversal, China is the type of country that will basically say, the hell with America's stuff, we'll go someplace else and start bringing in products. Remember, there's other places in the world that also has products.
Oh, no doubt. In fact, they just talk about, when they talk about putting those tariffs in, they said, because China was importing a lot of soybean from American farmers, individual farmers, not the big agro people. And so this was a great benefit to them and a great source of income for them. And then if that happens, they said they could easily get soybean from South America and other places. So bump the American worker, American farmer.
Yeah. So now you placing yourself in a position to where as you're going to have to deal with that type of ramification. And the thing is, the media is so dishonest that they'll never tell the truth. And you'll hardly hear anybody from a black perspective tell the truth, because most of those Negroes are bought and paid for. I'll give you a perfect example. My vote. You know what I mean? I forgot her first name.
Julianne Melville.
Julianne Melville. Mm-hmm. She's an economist. But whenever you listen to her analysis, there's always a tint of blackness, but always a dominant of Europeanness. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Always a loyalty to America.
Right.
And that's the nature of the Negro peon. They'll never tell you the truth. They'll always try to make it seem as though the Urugu has to be the dominant factor because we can't govern ourselves. You know, but it's a slick way that they do it. And we're not mature enough to pick it up and to see it for what it really is. That's our problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're always looking for the Urugu to define what one position is here in America as an African. Got to stop it.
Okay.
If we stop doing that and we internally look at ourselves and deal with our scholars to put forward honest analysis on the position of African people, maybe we'll be in a better position. But as long as they're fence riders for the Yoruba, we're just going to be in the smokescreen.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
No, I
because
agree.
We're never going to be able to get the whole truth, nothing but the truth.
That's right.
So that's the dilemma that we are as an African people in. Because we think as though we're part of this madness because you got a Negro like Tyler Perry who's a degenerate. You got somebody like Oprah Winfrey, who's a mammy. And then you got some of the others who are in position, but they don't even come together collectively.
Right.
How the hell are you going to tell me I'm going to come collectively together to buy a football team that
right.
the Yoruba owns and controls, but I can't come together collectively to try and create something to where as it could be central based in each state to state that will be able to branch out to develop our people.
Right. Something more substantive, something more substantive that we could share about. You want to buy a damn a status thing, a football team, the hell with football, you know. And
who cares about it?
It's the same thing here.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Who, it's the same thing here because here you have in Atlanta, in the metropolitan Atlanta, Georgia area. Now, understand something. Atlanta is small in size and number. Only like about 400-some thousand, over 400-some thousand people live in Atlanta. It is the metropolitan area that's huge because Atlanta's in like five different counties. That's what makes it like 6 million people. But given that fact, here the deal is that the number of people who've moved here with money, because you can get land and you can build a home on there. Let's say you can get the land, a beautiful plot of land, maybe near water and all of that kind of good stuff, build you a $4 or $5 million home. That would cost you $15 million on the West Coast and $15 million on the East Coast. So it's more advantageous and economical for you to buy it here. So a number of people have done that. And so therefore, because of that, this has become the widest disparity of our people who have and who have not within that disparity. And the problem, of course, is that those men and women in that have not group, they don't communicate. They don't say, hey, you know what? Let's pull our resources and compete with the food stores, the supermarkets here, and have some supermarkets that are owned and run by our people. There's not one supermarket in this damn city that is owned and operated by our people. It's a damn shame.
And you got individuals, there who would go and spend a penny at the Kroger's, at the Winn-Dixie's,
right.
at the Walmart's, and all of these establishments,
right,
to make that Yoruba witch,
exactly,
but won't collectively come together to
exactly
just
to
create
with
a business,
right,
to where as we could feed ourselves. Where we could give a place for black farmers to sell their products.
And provide
and
jobs.
Able to grow and develop and provide jobs and all of these things.
Right.
But, you know, this is the sickness that we suffer from, Oshi, because like I said earlier, we as African conscious community haven't came together collectively and put forward the necessary ideas to counterattack this Negro peeing Yoruba lover. You know what I mean? If we were able to do that and figure out a way to do it, then we could do these things. Because a Negro like Tyler Perry should be held accountable. You understand what I'm saying? Even though, from my understanding, he has created a lot of jobs. He has done a lot of good things, from my understanding, in Atlanta in regards to that whole entertainment thing. Because I noticed when a lot of times when you see black shows, they're done at his studio
right.
in Atlanta.
Right.
You know what I mean? Which is a good thing.
But that's a good
but
thing.
I don't have a problem with that.
I don't either. But
we have to develop on a broader level.
And exactly. There should be some type of balance. When he's putting off all these Real Housewives of Atlanta, all this other garbage, he needs to put something, produce some shows with substantive, with some substance that are substantive, and also too thought provoking, conscious, African centered
consciousness.
I know.
No, that's not that you can't. You know, unfortunately, Brother Oshie,
I know.
Can't expect that to from him because we haven't figured out a way how to approach him and present that. It's just like, you know, everybody is so hyped and happy about this Black Panther movie, which is cool. But let's see where it develops. You know what I mean? I'll give you a last example. You got this Yoruba lover, Byron Allen, who everybody is talking about, just went out there and paid $300 million for the weather trend. Now, mind you, he doesn't get the website, the apps, or nothing, just the Weather Channel. Now, my question to you is this, in regards to Byron Allen, why is it with him having a distribution company, a movie distribution company, why aren't blacks collectively coming together, producing products and taking it to him for distribution? If he has a distribution network, and I think in that distribution, there is ownership of numerous movie theaters without and around this country. That was part of that distribution deal, from my understanding. I may be wrong. But,
I don't know.
I'm just trying to say, we have to present product and demand that our product is distributed by these Neanderthal, Yoruba-loving Negro peens, because they have to then be held accountable. And if we do the work and we do the presentation and we collectively come together, then we will move forward. But until we do that, we're just going to be talking and beating our head up against the wall, still waiting and wishing that the daddy take his foot out our behind. And we're still going to love the Yoruba to the day we die and hope that the Yoruba, like I said, take his foot out our behind and just treat us a little better. Because that's all
that
the Negro peen wants from the Yoruba
is
just to not beat him
with
the whip.
All they want is to find a comfortable niche, a comfortable corner.
Yes.
In the European world.
Yes, they don't want to. They want to be beat. They want to be beat with a feather belt. They don't want to be beat with the whip. So they will accept the beating with the feather belt.
Yeah.
Something that is light. You know what I mean? Because the whip is too much for them, and they'll do everything in their power to keep people like me and you down and uplift themselves. But when they're said and all is said and done and you go see the creator, and when you have to look your face at the ancestors who went through the tragedy of our Holocaust will ask you this question.
What did you do?
Did you fight the Yoruba?
That's right.
Did you fight the Yoruba? See, that's all the ancestors want to ask you. Did you fight the Yoruba and go about trying to get payback for what was done to me your brothers and sisters and your aunties and your uncles and your cousins by this Yoruba? And if you go there and you meet the ancestors, say no, then you should be damned for forever.
That's for sure.
Because the bottom line is you didn't do nothing.
That's right.
Hotep, and I look forward to Monday.
Have a great weekend, brother. Have a great weekend, Jay. Peace to you. Thank you. Brothers and sisters, I hope you enjoyed this program today. We talked about a number of issues and topics. I hope you got something out of it. Please join us again next week. We end this program like we end all of our programs with the words of Stephen Biko, the most potent weapon in the hands of the European, the Caucasian, the cracker, the white man, the Yoruba, is the minds of the oppressed. And this program is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind. Not just the M-I-N-D, but the M-I-N-E, because under the feet of African people are all the resources that everybody wants, think they can't do without and don't want to pay for. Dr. John Henry Clark. Brothers and sisters, Shemhotep, go in peace. Asante Sana, thank you. God bless you. Have a good weekend.